Welcome back for another helping of oysters, clams, and cockles. I am Ross Bolin, joined today, as always, by my buddy, Mr. Barrett Dudley, to bring you the best TV shows and movies weekly in an easily digestible podcast packed with laughs. Barrett, what's good, player?
I'm just over here doing some detective work, see?
Oh, yeah, see?
Yeah, I'm looking for thread all over the city, see? There's so many types of thread.
Bro, that room, that room that he walked into when there's like 400 spools of thread, and it like dramatically shifts out and you see his eyes get big and then he's like realizing that he's never going to find where this fucking thread came from.
Yeah.
Was one of the most anticlimactic dramatic shots I've ever seen in cinema.
Well, I mean, it's hard for us to transport ourselves back to the 1930s in many ways.
Fair enough.
And it just seems so far-fetched in the first place that you would be able to take a little piece of thread and then go about identifying that thread by looking at all the thread shops in a city. Like, that's, right? Like, that's insane. That's insanity. But I guess,
maybe at
you know,
some point
we're talking damn near 100 years ago. So I guess, like, you know, the big thread industry has just really, it's really ballooned to the magnitude that we see today.
Yeah, in the 1960s, they found that big thread was mostly a monopoly, and they started to input all those regulations to keep big thread from getting back to this place it was.
Yeah, that's they wanted to foster competition among various thread providers and vendors, as it were.
Of course.
So yeah, that was really the end of big thread and being able to just, you know, get one small piece of thread and then track it down, you know.
Scientifically. Yeah, scientifically, what are we going to see at some point? At some point, are we going to see Perry looking through a microscope, analyzing different threads to see if they match? These are the questions we'll get into today. We enjoyed a couple months of levity. We had some lightness. We had more laughs than usual, silliness. Well, Barrett, we're back in the shit again between Dark and Perry Mason. The lights have gone out. July is clearly going to be a fucked up month.
Yeah, that's okay.
Is it?
Yeah, it is. Here's the thing. Right now, when I see fun things happening on TV, that actually makes me more depressed than the depressing stuff on TV. Because
why is that?
Well, because if I'm watching Perry Mason, I'm seeing this like noir 1930s version of Los Angeles. That means nothing to me. I have no tie to that. And if I'm watching Dark, it's in this small German town and
Vinden,
and it's just all gone to hell, and we're all over the place, and we're doing all sorts of science fiction stuff that I also have no basis for in my own version of
reality,
which is probably just a simulation,
a computer simulation,
anyways,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But if I'm watching, you know, something like fun where people are like hanging out and like seeing friends and going to parties and having a laugh, then that's what hits me in the feels, really. And I'm like, oh wow, 2020 is just a completely lost and wasted year.
I could not agree more. There's something too with Perry Mason in particular. Dark's a little different because it's so wild and out there and confusing and crazy intellectual. Perry Mason is very much like you said. It's more of like this L.A. noir detective work, and it takes me out of our real world and into a place that was arguably worse. You know, in terms of the technology and the world that we see Perry moving through, it's fucking insane, man. And we're gonna close today with Perry talk because I want Perry Mason is the third thing we're gonna talk about after some Ozark news and some Dark.
Okay,
because I do have so many thoughts on it. So let's first jump in. To support this show in exchange for 3 or 4 additional exclusive ad-free episodes of OCC every month, you go to patreon.com/oystersclamscockles. Patreon is just a platform that allows us to bring you more content in exchange for your direct support. Patreon.com, patreon.com/oystersclamscockles will get you either 3 or 4 additional ad-free episodes of this podcast every month. If you join the Crustacean Nation, you get 3. Mollusk Militia gets you 4. Mollusk Militia got their hotline call extravaganza 11.0 last week. The week before that, we did Movie Club on the King of Staten Island. Patreon is awesome. We have a great time there. If you want more OCC, if you want to support the show, patreon.com/oysters, clams, cockles. Barrett, to start today, very quickly, up front, we have huge news in the realm of Ozark. Season 4 is going to be a 14-episode final season of this show.
Okay.
They're going outside of the Netflix box and into a more HBO-ish realm. Where, you know how HBO does sometimes. They're like, we'll split these two seasons into, or this season into two seasons, and it'll be 7 episodes each or whatever.
Right, right. So is that what they're going to do? Are they going to go
halves? It sounds like two parts is what they're looking at here.
Now,
at least from a, from a storytelling standpoint. I don't know if they're going to release them separately. I'm going to look that up right now.
Well, in, so something similar was recently, now it's not, I don't think it's supposed to be a finale, but something similar recently happened with Billions, where COVID-19 cut shooting short.
Okay.
And so they had to stop, but they're releasing that half of the season. So is that a thing here where they had already recorded kind of like half of this next season? And then they were like, okay, well, because of the pandemic, what we really need to do is like tie this all up, put a bow on it.
It sounds like they haven't even started.
Gotcha. So this
everybody
is
purpose, to return.
This is intentional. This is how they want to kind of end the story, is with this longer season that they'll break into potentially two parts.
Two parts, yeah. And it sounds like that is not potential. It is going to be split into 2 7-episode parts.
Okay.
Unclear on how the release plans to go, but they brought back Chris Mundy as the showrunner, writer, and executive producer, and reunited Bateman as the creative force behind both parts of the new season, as Deadline puts it. So just interesting that they would go, instead of two, you know, this is all, instead of two more seasons, they've decided, no, we want to do one more season in two parts with 14 episodes. So whatever it is storytelling-wise, they just must have come to the conclusion that that was the best strategy, and we'll have to see how it plays out in time, which is like, I don't think.
Here's what I like about this news. It gives an endpoint, an official endpoint for this show.
So we don't have to worry about the floating.
Yeah, well, right. And it's always like, this is motivation to catch up, right? I know it's coming to an end. I know it's not going to go 9 seasons. We're going to wrap it up. It's a nice tight 4.5, basically.
That's how I feel with Better Call Saul. I'm like, I don't know if they're going to stop anytime soon.
No,
it feels very daunting.
Next season is the last season of Better Call Saul.
And is that 6?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm not as far behind as I thought. And I would say, same thing. That motivates me to want to go watch, because I know there's a final episode to get to.
And also, it also would seem that Netflix, kind of in this... Look, Netflix is losing stuff, right? Like, they're going to, at the end of this year, it won't have The Office anymore. Mm-hmm. And
they already lost Friends.
They already lost Friends. They already lost 30 Rock. They are, so this programming that they had from all these other networks that were originally part of the reason that people signed up for Netflix. I remember, I watched all of How I Met Your Mother for the first time on Netflix. You know, they're losing all of that. So what they're really trying to do now is just like stack their library with their own content. So that they're, you know, so that there is a ton of stuff for you to kind of like dive into and get into. And so I think that they've kind of shifted their mindset from the early days of like wanting House of Cards or Orange is the New Black to go 6, 7, 8 seasons. And now they are totally fine. Like this next season of The Crown, I believe, is the last season of The Crown as well. And so they're fine with just like wrapping up this stuff 3, 4 seasons and moving on to the next original program, because that's kind of what like feeds the hype. And it now they've got The Crown and they've got Ozark and they're going to have that forever. It's a nice tight 3 or 4 seasons that people can go tuck into, and they're going to keep like driving the train and making noise with new programs.
And I think, I mean, obviously, look, it's a short-sighted strategy. Mm-hmm. The throw as much shit at the wall as you can and see what sticks, right? If the move, just from a content perspective, from a guy who's spent his entire career in content, the move is always quality over quantity. It's just really difficult, the more money you have involved, to maintain that sort of like line of sight. And it seems like Netflix is getting to the point where, I love your point, man, nothing is more important to me now paying for a streaming service than their backlog.
Right.
I have absolutely no guarantee that anything good will come from any of these networks ever again. But if they have stuff in the backlog that justifies the price point for me, that's where I get pulled in. It's the thing that I think HBO Max was a huge step for HBO because it furthered the backlog that an HBO subscription allows me to access. Hypothetically, I still haven't figured out how to do it through Google Fiber, which is a real fucking problem, I might add. Thank you very much, Google Fiber, for not taking the time. Google doesn't give a shit about Google Fiber. Let me just tell you that straight up.
They could not care less. They've also essentially, like, they've abandoned it, as from what I understand. They are not installing any more fiber.
And, like, the first month I had it, I was like, hey, you guys ever going to get NBA League Pass so I can watch sports? Not that it matters anymore because we don't have sports. But they were like, oh, yeah, sure, hon, we're working on that. They don't do contracts with any of these outside people to get us the shit we need. So right now it literally tells me when I go try to install HBO Max, it's like, sorry, guy, it's not even that we don't have a deal, we just... don't know what to tell you. They said nope, and it just goes away. It's fucking awful.
That's unfortunate.
That backlog, dude, that's the thing that gives HBO the prestige it has. That's the thing, because people know, oh, if I get HBO, I get The Sopranos, I get Game of Thrones, I get The Wire, I get Hung. I'm just kidding. But all those shows...
John in Cincinnati? What was that one show that was like their biggest flop ever? Was it called John in Cincinnati?
That was another one of them. It was like Hung and That Show were the two worst ones I ever saw on HBO. Big Love. But yeah, there's all these fucking titles that you get access to, and Netflix needs to go more for that than they do like...
Right. Because just
name their prestige shows.
Exactly. And they are still... Yes, their main goal right now is to establish that big backlog of shows that people are interested to come and watch. Because if they think about it, if all they were doing is pumping out shows at a clip like HBO does, you know, a few new things every season, basically, like, are you that interested in Netflix?
Yeah, and it's weird because so much of their stuff is like
right now,
elsewhere.
I'm there for. Schitt's Creek and Great British Baking Show and The Office and they need to start getting more that of their own stuff, and a Great British Baking Show now qualifies as their own thing basically because of the deals that they have in place, but they got to make sure that they have their own stuff worth coming to the service for,
which they have some of, but when you think of it from like the produced and created by Netflix stamp, because like Dark, the first show we're gonna talk about today, mm-hmm. It is on Netflix, but it's not a Netflix production. It's in conjunction with like the BBC or whatever, right?
No, Netflix is Dark is a Netflix production.
So it's not.
That is a Netflix show. That is a Netflix Germany show.
Okay, so straight up, that's one of the ones they have then.
Yes, that will be on Netflix forever.
Mm-hmm. So then, like House of Cards, right?
Yeah. Orange is the New Black, The Crown.
Orange is the New Black. So all those were
Ozark.
Like years ago, though.
Right.
Ozark is the other one that's still hot.
I mean, I think you mentioned this maybe on the Patreon pod last week with a call, but like we talked about how Netflix doesn't have anything super hot at the moment. Right?
Does anybody
Dark is yeah, because we were talking about Dark's popularity, and we know that the Clam Fam is like very engaged with Dark, but we're not really sure how widespread their U.S. viewership is for that show. Yeah, because we were talking about how the hurdle here is the subtitles on this show.
Yes,
and not everybody is down to watch a show that's this confusing already, and on top of that, now you've got to read subtitles. So it's like, you know, so we're stoked on Dark right now. But other than Dark, what is new and hot on Netflix, like right this second? The Epstein doc?
It's a lot of documentaries, right?
Right.
Like that's really been their bread and butter this past, I don't know.
Yeah, Tiger King. They had Tiger King earlier, but they don't have I don't feel like they have a new hot show right this second.
And most of their stuff that has been hot is sort of flamed out before, like Orange is the New Black didn't carry, man. Like that didn't, you know, you didn't see it winning all the Emmys at its last season or whatever the fuck. Like that's not that show.
No.
It's just it's an interesting position. It's always the thing we've discussed about Netflix that makes them interesting is that they have so much, and then it's like, how do you How do you, like, what is their brand at this? It's just so confusing. Shows are coming on, shows are coming off, shows get bought by other places, they go other elsewhere, they lose their contracts with this, they get another contract with that. They're dropping silly shit, Space Force, they've got Dark. It's like, it's just sort of all over the place still, and they've kind of struggled to reel it in. But you can feel that sort of, like you said, I see the shift happening a little bit, where it feels like they need to be more aware of that and get more prestige drama shows under their belt.
The biggest thing that Netflix has going for it is that they're kind of the, in a lot of ways, Netflix is like the Coca-Cola or the Kleenex or the Rollerblade, right? Like Netflix is synonymous with streaming television.
Yes.
Right? That's the original saying. It's Netflix and chill. It's not HBO Max and chill.
Right.
It's not, you want a Hulu and chill.
Right.
So that's what it has going for it, I think, first and foremost, is that it's just like the, when we think of streaming television, Netflix is right there on the very top of the list as the streaming service. And so I think that will carry them for a while. But as they continue, like they obviously know that they need to continue improving the backlog as well as releasing new shows.
Because it's kind of the thing that all these other companies have sort of brought as their haymaker, right? Like Disney Plus, what was the huge draw? They didn't give a fuck about new shows. They dropped like one thing, The Mandalorian. It was the backlog, bro.
The backlog, every Disney movie ever, yep.
Yep, and with HBO Max, the same kind of thing, man. It's getting drawn in by the bigger and badder offering, and Netflix is no longer like the sole, you know, people are going to start to feel, that's the thing they want to avoid.
Yeah.
To get to a place where people ask, do I need Netflix?
Yep.
You don't want that happening. So,
right.
Speaking to that, they have dropped what is probably, to me, their best, it is their best original series going right now. Dark Season 3, Episode 1, you and I just watched. And Dark, as you said, has been one of the more confusing, insane. I think it's way smarter than me. I don't know yet. I can't tell if it's because I need it to finish before I can definitively say that. But it's one that makes me feel stupid every time I watch it because I'm like, ah? And the first two seasons were so nuts. We almost always leave not having a fucking clue what's going to happen next. And episode one of season three was certainly par for the course as far as dark confusion goes.
So I would actually, I'm just going to jump right in here.
Yeah, please do.
So I told you kind of when we were texting a little bit about the show that I didn't think a ton happened in episode one. And I stand by that statement. It really did. It did one thing and one thing only.
What did it do?
It put Jonas into the alternate world where he doesn't exist.
Right.
That's it. It introduced us to the new alternate dimension world, whatever you want to call it, the one where Jonas does not exist.
And let me ask you this. So
that's it. That's all we do in episode one.
When Marta, so season two ends with Marta being shot by oldest version of Jonas,
yep.
Candleface Jonas,
aka Adam.
And then, wait, was it Adam or the older version? Was it Adam or Melty Face?
Melty Face is Adam.
But was it younger priest version or old version that shot her? It was the oldest version, I think, right?
I'm pretty sure it was the oldest Melty Face Adam, yes.
Okay. And
not long-haired, middle-aged Jonas.
Right. So she, then, this alternate Marta shows up, Marta, and explains to Jonas that she's from another world and that she needs to, now she needs to make everything right. And like this season setup is almost a lot like season one, but you're being introduced to this alternate world version of it, right? There's a missing boy. There's a squad running around in the forest, dating each
yes.
other.
There's and really, really everything is about the same. There are a few wrinkles, but even the like Eric Ollendorf or whatever his name is, the original
yep.
missing boy, that's the same.
As it was in season one.
Yeah, same first missing kid.
But this is the world where we would see what it would be like if Jonas never existed.
Yes, exactly.
Like you said, look, man, I don't know that I've ever watched an episode of Dark and felt like I could definitively tell you a whole bunch of shit that happened after the fact. It's always sort of like, just trying to come to grips with where the episode ends and then go from there. And in this case, yeah, you're right. It is rather simple in terms of its big picture message.
Yeah.
But in terms of what that entails for the rest of the season?
Well, so just to kind of spin off a few of the things that we've discussed in the past and on other podcasts and maybe on Patreon a little bit as well, we've kind of rounded in on this, on one of these theories here, where everybody in this world stems from the same somewhere between 2 and 4 people, right? Or 2 and 6 people.
So I was
or whatever it's there's a theory that kind of stands there, right?
And it's that origin theory. It's 5 people in my mind, and it's the ones in the bunker at the end of the episode. Like when Mikkel drops from the portal with his eyes burned out by the machine or whatever, it made me think that the people in that bunker are the 5 people that every other person in Winden originates from. Just because we've had that theory sort of going for years now, right?
After
season
came,
1.
I would say it's season 2, really.
Is when that came into... Yeah, no, it became more clear and clear through season 2 that was a real possibility, but like...
Yeah.
When they're going down into that bunker and then they shut the door and then Mikkel drops from the blue black portal that shows up.
Yeah, and that's Mads.
Mads, sorry. When it made me think... Oh shit, maybe these are the origin. These 5 people that are in this bunker, because we always end up in that goddamn bunker. Like we always end up down there, bro. And it's not entirely. You know that stupid meme from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia where Charlie is, we always reference it. It's the one where he's pointing at the wall with the thousands of things of string.
Yep.
Never has anything been more fitting than that meme for this show.
AKA the Kerry Matheson.
Yes. Yes. But this is the show where I always feel like that guy in that scene. I'm always trying to make sense of it and all the different threads. Yeah. No pun intended.
So here's another thing that I fully expected to happen in this episode, and I was actually really disappointed when it didn't. Jonas is in the Jonas-less world.
Yes.
And an older woman walks up to him.
Yes.
And she's got the bangs going, so we're pretty sure that this is old Marta, right? Mm-hmm. I was positive that she was going to introduce herself as Eve.
Oh, you thought they were going to go full Adam and Eve?
Yes, because what they're telling us here in episode 1 is that the reason that all of this happens is specifically because of Jonas and Marta. And we already know that old-ass Jonas, melt-faced Jonas, calls himself Adam.
Yes.
Which is clearly a reference. You know, they've got the very famous, like, Renaissance painting of hell, of all, like, the souls burning in hell on Adam's wall back there in the 1800s. Man. And it's like, there's all sorts of these kind of, like, biblical references there. So I really thought that they were going to go with Eve there, where, like, she's the Eve in this Jonas-less world, and he's the Adam in the world with Jonas, and together, like because of whatever, they continue to manifest this happening, this recurring cycle, basically.
Right.
I think. Did you watch the little 5-minute the thing at the very beginning of the episode?
Oh yeah.
Gave you a bit of a refresher.
Yeah, it was chaos.
They start to ask some questions in there, and. You know, not that this is new for us to know about the show, but it all boils down. This is another: do we have free will, or is everything predetermined? Show that is what the show is. It's revolving around this exact same concept that Westworld and devs are exploring as well. And it kind of says something there in that little 5-minute, you know, intro to the show, the refresher course. That's like. Does what lies within you always determine what happens to you, no matter what you try to do to fix or change it?
Right.
Right? And in a way, the things that you attempt to try to fix and change are what create the problem and the happenings in the first place. And every time you change it or you try to change it, nothing actually changes because they're all tied together. And this gets into the whole bootstrap paradox of Dark. And because we've just been on one this year in 2020, this is some interstellar shit too, right? Trying to figure out these timelines. And so I got to thinking about Interstellar when McConaughey is in the black hole, right? And he's seeing the fractalized version of the library where he can see the library at every single point in time.
Hundreds of bookshelves, yeah.
Hundreds of bookshelves. And it's just at every moment in time here, they all exist right at the same quote unquote time in our sense of linear time.
Sure.
And you talk about like a fourth or a fifth dimension that we don't really understand. What if, and this is popular like talk in time travel stuff, but if every moment in time actually does exist all around us, all at the same time, if 20 years ago exists at the same time as now, exists as 20 years in the future, if they all exist at the same time, then like none of them are really changeable because they all are happening at the same time.
Right.
So what you do in one of them is inextricably tied to the others, to the other two in that situation. So there is no
disconnecting each other.
Yeah, exactly. Because you can't change the past to change the present to change the future because they're all happening already. They're all connected. And so I feel like that's kind of that's what the show I think wants to ask is even if you could talk to your past, present, and future self all at the same time, would you be able to change anything about the way that you are and what
now
happens because of who you are?
Or would it all adjust and end up the same?
Does it all end up the same
no matter what?
Which dials you tweak? Yeah.
Exactly. Okay, let me ask you this, because you brought up a really good point about past, present, and future. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that season 3, episode 1 is the first time we ever see a past, present, and future version of a person together at the same time.
Yes.
And it's in the form of, name slipping my mind, but that bad-looking motherfucker who goes into what ends up being, inevitably, the mansion where Adam is with his painting and his melty candle face, mm-hmm. and they burn the whole fucking thing down. They murder the old man who's inside there, who I don't know who the fuck that guy was. No clue. Didn't
yep.
follow.
No idea.
And then they just set everything on fire. And it's, you know, creepy as hell watching three people who are the same person. At one point, they fold their arms the same way right before the other one commits the act. And it's just like, it's very eerie. And it's, it was like, what the hell was that? I guess is my question. What the fuck was that? They just showed up. They killed that old man. They set the whole room on fire. And then we have no idea what the fuck that means.
That's, yeah. Yes, they were very vague with that.
Dude,
we have no idea what that was.
Dark is the king of giving you a scene that makes you go, dude, that was heavy. And then makes you go, but I don't have any idea what it means or in context to the story if it holds any weight.
Yeah.
And then sometimes that stuff will come back and connect and you'll be like, holy God. And sometimes you're just like, well, that was just dramatic. All in all, like you said, we end the episode with old alternate Marta who tells Jonas, I am not your Marta. I'm here to help you find the origin, the one thing that's the beginning
of
everything.
Yeah, she's like, that's alternate world, kind of present Marta.
Yes. And she
shows up in other world, 1800s. We don't know how Jonas got there. We don't know how middle-aged Jonas got there, but he's working on some Nikola Tesla looking shit.
He looks good. It's like the healthiest version of middle-aged Jonas we've ever seen.
Yeah.
In terms of being dressed and well pimped.
He's a little less gaunt.
He does.
A little bit more fat in the cheeks, I feel like.
He's been eating better, at least. His diet has improved. And then this bitch shows up and it's probably going to ruin everything. but she does specify, like, okay, so if the whole season is about, and this is the last season, and it's about finding the origin in both worlds, Barrett.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got 9 episodes left.
Only 7.
I'm
so it's
sorry.
It's an 8-episode season.
Even fewer hours than I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Do you foresee Dark ending in a way that makes you go, oh, holy shit, and it's like a concrete finish? Or do you foresee it sort of sticking with the same vein that is it, that we've seen so many of these shows that attack this subject matter end up in, which is sort of like you can't really give an answer, you don't know how to close, and you just stumble through the finish line and hit the fucking light switch and hope that people enjoy it?
I mean, the smart money is on
the latter, right?
The latter there. These shows that deal with these concepts are just too difficult to stick. Because as we've talked about before, like, we don't have this science. We don't know these. We don't know how this stuff would actually work if it did work.
Yeah, it's like hypothetical science
fiction.
Otherwise,
we'd be able to time travel. Right? Like,
yes.
You know what I mean? So we're just kind of making shit up here, and you got to figure out the best way to kind of explain yourself as to how the machinations of all this are. And at this point, we got, like, we don't even know when the time machine was invented. Now, Otherworld Marta has the little ball version of the whole shebang.
Fucking Pokeball travel, yeah.
Like, the entire group of kids, like you said, the bunker kids, as we'll call them.
Sure.
They're now time traveling. They started time traveling at the end of season two, and now they keep doing it. So, I mean, like, it. No, I think that, like most of these shows, I think the show wants to ask questions more so than it wants to give answers.
Yeah, 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 for sure. Which is fair.
So,
I'm fine with that.
That's okay. I certainly hope that we get some. Look, go for it, man. Dark, please do your best to tell me
what happened here,
what the hell all this meant, and how it was happening. And if it doesn't make any sense, that's fine. At least you tried.
And you had a great run along the way. More than any show we've watched like this, though. Like, first of all, we should give devs some credit. I thought they did a good job. It was one season. It was confusing as all hell. But in the end, I felt like I had a concrete understanding of exactly what I had witnessed.
Yeah, you pretty much knew. Yeah, they did a decent job.
Was it crazy to try to wrap your head around? Of course, but it was easy to understand from just a baseline standpoint of what the fuck they accomplished and what they were doing and what was the point of the show. With Dark, I have some degree of confidence that they can end up in the same place because of what we spoke to, you know, when we found out season three was going to be the final season. There was always this finality to it. They knew where their end date was. They knew what they were shooting for, and it feels like they wouldn't have done that and continued to further complicate the show in season three unless they knew exactly where they were going. So I'm holding out.
Yeah, that piece of it is certainly, does give you hope. A little bit of hope. Mm-hmm. The fact that they always intended this for this to be three seasons, and they kind of had this endpoint in mind. And so that does make you feel like they do have a direction. They do have something to tell you here in these last seven episodes. One thing I wanted to give a shout to the visuals of this episode, because I am pretty sure, and I don't know how they achieved this, whether it was camera tricks or whether it was set tricks, but I'm pretty sure everything was flipped in Alternate World.
Like from a...
Like it was a mirror. Yeah, it was like a mirror image. So like...
No way.
Jonas's bed was... Like
on
that
the other
room
side?
Is flipped. Yeah. So the bed and the window were on the other side.
Holy shit.
And I in the school, I think that where you walk up, you know, like the brick wall in Original World is like on the left. This time was on the right. So I'm pretty sure. And I kept trying to catch them. I kept trying to like look at like the tags on doors and stuff, or like exit signs or numbers, to see if they had just taken the footage and flipped it. And I couldn't find anything where they had slipped up. Now it's possible that they knew what they were on top of it all, and so they made all the numbers reversed so that when they flipped it, it looks right. And then it was cool how the Nielsens all have dark hair in this world instead of blonde hair, except for Mom.
Damn.
There was a lot of like really cool like little flips like that where stuff is just slightly different or the opposite in alternate No Jonas world?
There is so much shit in this show. Like, if you ever go read a recap of Dark on any website, pretty much, it's almost comical because, I mean, I'm assuming it's just like what it would look like if you put our words down on paper. But because you end up in this place where it's like you can make sense of certain things and pull logic from certain areas of this show. But excuse me, overall big picture, you still end every episode like, I have no fucking idea what the shit is going on. And it's supposed to be that way. So like one of the areas that was so dude, who showed up covered in like oil? Which chick was that?
Yeah, I think that was Marta, but that was some creepy shit, dude. I was getting chills when she whispers Marta, and then whatever that person was, don't know. Again, don't know.
And I like on it, when we were texting yesterday, and you were like, "All right, two Perry Masons or two Darks?" And I was just thinking because I'd already watched Perry Mason one, and I know Dark, and I was like, "Nah, man, fuck that. I can't do two Darks." And now I see why you wanted to, and it's because this episode is so much like, it's a beautiful setup. It takes things from the first two seasons and puts them into play for the third in a totally different scenario where you have no clue what's going on yet again. And that is what I want with this series, man. And it's like, I can't wait to watch episode two and try to make more sense of episode one, and that's always the way that Dark has made me feel.
Yeah, now what I'm curious about, I am curious as to how much time we're going to spend in No Jonas world, because they're doing a lot of setup there. Like,
yeah,
like Ulrich,
man,
is having the Ulrich and some of the other stuff that now I'm remembering some of the other stuff that was different. One-eyed guy is missing an arm instead.
TikTok.
TikTok guy is missing an eye. He's not in Jonas world.
Okay.
The cop, I'm talking about the partner,
yeah,
who has one eye in Jonas world.
Missing an arm?
Has both eyes, but missing an arm here.
Holy shit.
In this world. When Charlotte goes to see the head of the nuclear power plant, I'm almost positive that office is flipped. What else? She has blonder hair instead of darker hair. She's like a little bit more tan. Her daughters, it's flipped. Which one is deaf?
Oh yeah, dude.
The little girl can speak, but
the redhead who's dating
Marta's brother is deaf. So there's just all these little like
flips.
Just minor tweaks, flips, changes, yeah, which I thought was all pretty well executed.
So the kid that's missing...
Marta's brother is all, like, tatted up and
yeah, he's got
that going on.
Got the chest tats and shit. That dude's always banging no matter what time frame you're in, no matter what time zone you're in.
Yes.
He can't stop. He just can't stop banging.
He's just riding around. He just rides around and gets him, man.
The Eric Obendorf kid that's missing... In this other version or whatever. Do we even know who the fuck that is, or is that a completely new character?
So, in No Jonas world, Eric Obendorf's brother is the one dating Marta.
Oh, fuck. Okay, Killian, is that the name?
Killian, yeah. And I don't know if Killian exists or not in Jonas world.
This shit, dude. Good Lord.
Oh, Bartosz has long hair instead of short hair.
Yeah. Damn, I did not catch the flip stuff. I'm going to have to watch the first episode again now. Thanks a lot. Now I'm going to have to fuck. Because I remember being like, I kept noticing this that things were different, but I just, it didn't click in my head that was why. Dark season three has come, that was a hot start to me, man. Like you said, in terms of big picture movement, was there a ton? Nope. Did I expect there to be? Probably not. So this is about par for the course as far as Dark goes. Incredible acting, very well written, visually stunning, and the most confusing thing I've ever seen. Hopefully episode two will further that.
Yeah. Well, another thing that I need to look into, or maybe some of the Clam Fam sleuths out there already have, I believe Marta is in a play in No Jonas World, as she is in Jonas World. In Jonas World Play, they're all like decked out in white.
Right.
They're it's like angelic, I believe, even. In No Jonas World, everybody's dressed in black. They've got their red face paint on their eyes. And it's like
the opposite, hell, dark,
yeah, it's
evil.
It's kind of hellish and devilish. Jonas sees the book that Marta leaves on her lab table. And I think it's called like Ariadne or something like that. I wonder if the plays that they're doing are two different plays that are kind of like
feed
into
all this
of coin there. Yeah, I need to look in. I should look into that.
Yeah, it looks like
something to look out for.
Ariadne is the name of a Cretan princess in Greek mythology associated with mazes and labyrinths. Damn it. That cannot be helpful, Marta. But yeah, excited for episode two. You want to talk Perry Mason?
Let's talk Perry Mason.
So
yes, yes.
HBO drops this new show that you and I discussed last week, was sort of out of nowhere, originally had Robert Downey Jr. attached as the lead character playing Perry Mason, inevitably ended up being the dude from The Americans, whose name is?
Matthew Rhys.
Thank you, Barrett. Barrett, I thought you did such a good job on what your description on Twitter of this show through two episodes was what?
Perry Mason, : True Detective season 4.
Yes. So do you feel like this is one that was like being written by a guy watching True Detective season 1?
Well, so here's the thing. Along with Robert Downey Jr. Originally slated to star in this, Nick Pizzolatto was originally on to showrun.
Shut up.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and then he left. He exited Perry Mason to go do True Detective season 3. So I would love to know more of the backstory there about why he left Perry Mason to go do True Detective season 3, why HBO had him already on Perry Mason and then took him off to go do True Detective season 3. Look, man, I don't know how far he got with like the skeleton of the story for Perry Mason season 1 before the other two showrunners and writers
took over.
But this has Pizzolatto's DNA all over it, dude. Like, it's the same. It's creepy stuff happening to kids. A messed up detective who's like addicted to, you know, who's reliant on substances and has, you know, a really
fucked up past.
Bloody, fucked up past. Just this whole like.
There's the occult,
yes,
the occult nature of it all.
The occult, yeah, exactly. Like it's dealing with like some weird shit happening that nobody can seemingly explain, and everybody's kind of tied and messed up to it. Distrust of law enforcement. It has all this hard boiled noir, weird, creepy stuff that Pizzolatto loves so much, very much, in its blood.
Yeah.
So I'm very interested to know kind of like how much of season 1 still has his fingerprints on it, because everything about it feels True Detective-ish. What's funny or sad or some mix of both is that it's the best season of True Detective through two episodes since the first one.
It is. It's far and away better than season 2 and 3.
Yes, absolutely.
That's been the big revelation for me through two episodes of Perry Mason, is that this is better than True Detective seasons 2 and 3. What I also didn't realize is that it is based on a series of detective stories written by Earl Stanley Gardner, who's this guy who was an American lawyer and author who passed away in 1970. But he wrote the story of Perry Mason that this is all based on.
Yeah, and so Perry Mason, this is pre-existing IP, obviously.
Yep.
And this was a very popular show after it was books, and it was a radio program.
Wow.
And then it was a very popular show starring Raymond Burr in the late 50s and early 60s.
Okay. So there you go.
And so it was like big network TV, but that, you know, when there were only three channels.
And they didn't go full dark and like this shit with it.
No. I was just talking to my dad about this, and he like remembers Perry Mason being one of the first shows that his family would watch when they first got a TV, like in the early 60s.
That's kind of dope.
Basically. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and This is positioned as a prequel to Perry Mason, because in Perry Mason, he is a defense attorney. He is a lawyer.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So they've backed it up here.
To where he's a PI.
Where he's a PI. So he doesn't even have a law degree yet, basically.
That's wild, yeah.
And this is kind of, I guess, going to be, you know, they can go as long as they want, essentially, but this is building up to him becoming a defense attorney, doing all this PI work. Obviously, the show Perry Mason was family fair. This is some dark-ass HBO shit that they have really taken liberties with. And like we talk about, man, like I don't know who originally wanted the IP, whether it was Pizzolatto or whoever, but somebody wanted to do another noir, dark LA detective show about messed up stuff happening. And they were like, oh, let's package it in Perry Mason. People know that name. Because this didn't have to be Perry Mason at all, man. This literally could have been just True Detective Season 4.
Yeah, and it's an interesting angle to have it be Perry Mason as the piece of IP, as the show title. I mean, that's...
Dude, it is just an intro. It's like, it's a way people say, oh, I remember Perry Mason.
Yep.
And they're automatically more interested in the show than they otherwise would be if it was just called, like,
True Detective Season 4.
Or Chris Nicholson.
Well, what I mean is any name as your show title, that's saying a whole fucking lot, dude. Like, naming the show Perry Mason is a very big deal to me, because that does not give you the room to then veer into like, they can't kill fucking Perry, bro. You know what I'm saying?
No, no. This is however long they want to go with this. It's Perry Mason at the helm.
And that was interesting to me to sort of think of it from that angle. And Matthew Rhys as Perry Mason is very, very good. And what you find is that this show starts as like a sort of simple L.A. noir detective situation over a very dark crime. It becomes more and more complicated, and it does it quickly. That's what I love about Perry Mason so far. The pacing has been spectacular. It is not making me wait till episode 4 or 5 to get more details or to figure out that the fucking mom was involved or bring in the affair or start unraveling. It's giving it to me now, and it's showing me Perry's past. It's bringing in elements of both race and sexuality that I did not expect. It's playing in the 1932 Great Depression as it grips the United States and Los Angeles. But L.A. is sort of has this oil boom going on in the film industry, in the summer's Olympic Games, and a massive evangelical Christian revival. And everything that goes into this, it's just become much more meaningful than I expected initially. I expected just another dark show with crime and a dead baby in episode 1. And then what it has turned into is deeper than that. And so I don't, like you asked, I don't know what made them go with this IP or make this decision to do Perry Mason, or how the stuff unfolded with Pizzolatto, or how much coke he got to do and write about this show before he bounced to season 3 of True Detective or whatever. But this is it for me. This is, did not take long for me to be all the way in on this show. And to buy into what they've got working here, especially because they have such a cool angle going with like the religious shit that they're playing into this. All that stuff is crazy fascinating to me. I love that they made Perry either, you know, bisexual or homosexual or on some range of the sexuality spectrum that is making anyone else in 1932 uncomfortable, that he got like this, what is it called, a blue ticket from the military?
So, okay, we should talk about that scene.
Yeah.
I don't think that he is bisexual or homosexual.
You think he was fucking with this guy?
Yeah.
Because he leans in and tells him I was queer once.
The guy gets under his skin by saying that blue tickets are only for
Negroes, you know, and homosexuals.
I'm quoting here, Negroes and homosexuals, and what is it? He says, you don't look like a Negro or something like that.
And he says, no, and I'm a quarter Welsh and queer only once.
And queer only once, whatever. I think that was just like a clapback meant to be, you know, kind of
gotcha
sarcastic.
Because then he gets
then
into,
he says, "I heard they called you the butcher of something,
Mount Fakan or whatever." Yeah.
So I think that he's basically like a borderline war criminal, is how he got the blue ticket.
Gotcha. This is interesting.
If you get a regular blue ticket, or if you get a blue ticket and you're not black or gay, it's because you did something really, really, really fucked
up. Okay, here's what I'm reading on Esquire now. That in 1914, the military turned to blue discharges, also called blue tickets, to remove soldiers even suspected of being gay from the military. But it does sound like it was specific to being gay, or I guess being black.
So, okay, maybe, I mean, I guess we'll see.
It does say it's a stain on America's military history that was never quite atoned for. Oh, yeah? Well, nobody ever told me about it. Had no idea that was a thing that existed.
Yeah, that was a confusing piece right there. Because then we go into the second World War One flashback where he's killing his own dudes, putting them out of their misery.
Out of mercy, yeah.
And you can kind of see how, like, that's probably a no-no.
I mean,
I don't know.
I don't think that's what he's going to get brought to the military tribunal for. Okay. I think it's going to be something completely different.
Okay.
Because here's the thing. Somebody would have to be watching him go around executing guys that were already dying and then somehow report it or some shit.
Yeah.
Yes, it was weird to watch him sort of like taking steps to ensure that the suffering of these individuals was ended in a more swift fashion, personally executing each of them. But I have a hard time thinking that's why he's called the Butcher of Mount Fakan. I'm thinking it's going to be because he does some wild shit as a result of his experience that we saw in these first two episodes, perhaps later on. But you could be right, too. I have no idea. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, no, there certainly seems to be more there. I did just, since we're here on the topic of his military history, we watched 1917.
We did.
Last year. We did a Patreon podcast on it. It was
our movie club, yes.
The Clan Fam. If you haven't seen it or you've just watched it or you want to go watch a World War movie now because Perry Mason has your interest, watch 1917. It's incredible. We did a podcast on it on Patreon as well. There aren't a lot of movies about it. They're not a ton. And I mean that in comparison to stuff like Vietnam and World War II, where we have a ton of like very hallowed cinema.
Not a lot of World War I.
Around those wars. There's really only a few for World War I. And not many recent ones until 1917. It is such a horrifying war with the trench warfare and like the mixture of guns and hand-to-hand combat, and it's where like gas warfare was like first involved as well. Like, I mean, it was just absolutely gutting and horrifying. And every time I see it depicted on screen, I'm just like shocked. And I don't even understand. It's beyond like my capacity for understanding how they even convinced men to go do this.
Like how they were like, all right, here's the strategy. This is what we're going to do. Here's how these trenches are going to work. Most of us are going to die. Let's go. And everybody was like, tight, 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 tight.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I'm sure that there are dudes that are, you know, are basically having conniption fits and have to be dragged out. But how was that not like 80% of them?
Yeah, that's the thing that's pretty astounding. And I think generally speaking, it is the intensity, the situation of warfare puts you into a different place where you're forced to react on adrenaline and your basic instincts alone. You don't apply regular emotional depth to being in that trench. I don't think your brain processes it that way. Your brain finds ways to protect you from reality. And you disassociate, honestly. That's probably what a lot of it was, dude. People disassociating so that they could sacrifice their lives for another mile of land.
Yeah, it's really, really beyond. It's just amazing, and it's amazing how times change, right? Because like, even if there was a World War III now, not only would it involve nothing like that style of warfare, but even if they tried to institute a draft today, do you know how well that would go over?
It wouldn't go well.
It wouldn't. There would be, I mean, like, it would just be complete chaos. That's what we live in now, so it would be par for the course, I guess. But like, nobody would agree to that.
No, it would be a massive controversy. Yeah.
Like, you would have so many people just saying no, dodging the draft, moving, fleeing the country. Like, unless you're going to start monitoring the borders and arresting your own citizens trying to escape at every access point that there is, like, there just wouldn't be that. People don't, like, the psychology of our humanity
is different now.
In the 2000s is different.
Very
now.
Different.
People are not willing to go die like that. And so it's just what one of the interesting things that Perry Mason is doing that I've never really seen anything, movie or TV before. I'm sure it exists, but I like how they're playing with this guy having these flashbacks. It's interesting because he is now out living in the real world with a real job and has a awful, awful, awful past. Mm-hmm. Like, and there were a bunch of dudes like that. And I know that there are Vietnam guys too, right?
Well, all that, guys that come that back. Came back and I mean, like, think about the last 20 years or 10 years with Iraq
even,
and Afghanistan.
Even now that with what they the PTSD. Yeah, I mean, it's a big thing. And it's so anything that that deals with that, like, you're trying to be a regular person now after you were dealing, like, after you spent years murdering people. Killing people, murdering them. Not to mention watching all of your people get murdered as
and
well.
Having to put your own guys out of their misery.
Like that, it's just, I don't know. It's really, it's sitting with me. And I'm talking through it now and I'm realizing that, like, yes, this is something that still exists today. People come back from even our modern wars and really, really struggle with what they did over there.
Sure.
Barry is dealing with this. So I'm wrong. This, a lot of
yes,
of
but to your
films
point,
and TV shows
it is
deal with this.
Completely different now.
But this is, yeah. But this is maybe it's just the first time where I'm seeing one where it's like World War, where they're tackling this with a World War I past, as opposed to a more modern past. Even something like the Bradley Cooper one. What was it called?
American Sniper.
The American Sniper kind of dealt with a lot of this.
You know, I'm looking at World War I movies here, and in one of your personal favorites of all time, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, is listed as a World War I movie.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to remember the scenes where they tied that in, but I can't in my head. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it's a little bit, but not a ton.
To your point, though, it's like War Horse, 1917, Wonder Woman plays with it some, but from a superhero standpoint, obviously a totally mm-hmm. different vibe. There are not a Flyboys. There are not a ton of movies about World War I, and that's in most part because it was truly and utterly miserable.
The famous one is that there's a Stanley Kubrick one that we've talked about before.
A World War I movie?
A World War I film.
Ew, let me look. Stanley Kubrick, World War I. Paths of Glory, is that it?
Yeah.
Paths of Glory.
That's a very famous
one. Have not seen that one. If it's the same subject matter, I'm not sure I need to. 1917 was the first movie that ever opened my eyes up to how brutal. The brutality of World War I, Barrett, could be argued it is the thing that drove us to find and harness technology for the avoidance of ever having to be in a situation like that again. In every war since, we have seen technology replace human beings.
And I don't want to. I'm thinking about everything that I just said about how Perry Mason is sticking out to me because of this. I don't mean to lessen anybody's experience in modern warfare that comes back and deals with
of course
the PTSD.
Not, of course not.
What I think what I'm finding interesting is that in this setting, in this 1930s setting, I don't even think they understand the PTSD yet.
Oh,
right?
No. They most certainly do not. They don't have any of the shit we have now for treating this.
Right. And even the resources now are wanting, from what I
very
understand,
much so.
for our veterans. But back then, I don't even think that they were, it wasn't even on like their radar. You didn't have a choice to like go get therapy or counseling or help with your mental health. You just were expected to come back and deal with it and live a regular life. So that's a piece of it that is interesting. And then on top of that, just like kind of what I'm saying is like, I have an understanding of what a modern war looks like, of what it's like to go patrol a village in Afghanistan or something. And it just is more recognizable, right? Because we've played paintball and we've played Call of Duty and we've seen Desert Storm on the TV and we know about the Iraq War and we're just very familiar with it. So when you see the horrors of something that is unrecognizable like World War I and then try to put yourself back there and you know just how horrific that war was and just merciless, and then you know that there wasn't any type of resource to deal with that type of stuff when you got back. That's kind of the difference that I'm drawing
here. Man, it's really crazy to think about, but like in the 1930s, if you came back and struggled mental health-wise, you had a pretty good chance of ending up in some kind of institution. It's crazy to consider, like as a mental health patient, it's crazy to consider that if I was born in the 30s, in all likelihood, I would have ended up in some kind of fucking institution because I've gone to the hospital multiple times for mental health ailments. It had nothing to do with physical anything. And if you did that shit in the 30s, bro, they didn't let you out. You stayed in there. After a couple trips, they stopped letting you out. So it's going to be wild to see how Perry deals with all of his trauma. We've seen some of it, the drinking and the smoking. And then he's focusing on solving these crimes as a way to sort of use the darkness inside of him for some good, right? But it's obviously torturing him internally. And we're still seeing these flashbacks to what he had to do on the battlefield and how that's impacting him modern day in the midst of the Great Depression, in the midst of a country in turmoil, which is, it's the thing about this show that was a pleasant reminder that, look, life has never been easy. There's not a generation of Americans that can tell you, like, nothing went wrong. That doesn't exist. And the varying degrees to which we face challenges as human beings, obviously they change. Perspectives change. Technology changes. Times change. Bruh, World War I was a goddamn nightmare. Now, we're in a waking nightmare at the moment, too, bro, but I am very happy to not be alive in 1932.
Yeah, so American casualties, 116 over 116,000 deaths of American soldiers. So just to give you a comparison, the total tally that we give for deaths in the Iraq War for American soldiers is 4,400.
Jesus. Yeah, it's a large difference, Barrett.
So this was just mass death on a graphic, grotesque scale.
Listen to this. Here, this is Wikipedia. The total number of military and civilian casualties in World War I were about 40 million. Estimates range from around 15 to 22 million deaths and about 23 million wounded military personnel, ranking it among the deadliest conflicts in human history.
Yeah.
9 to 11 million military personnel alone. And the civilian death toll between 6 and 13 million. Obviously, these are very large spans, and it's incalculable. Incalculable? Is that a word? You know what I'm trying to say.
Uh-huh,
In terms of the exact number. We will never know the exact toll of World War I because it was a long time ago, and it was fucking insane, and there was diseases involved. There was a shit ton of poverty involved. Yeah. And these are all these things we're starting to see swept up into our society again, but... man, I didn't realize how much of a mirror you could hold to the 30s and the Great Depression and 2020. And it turns out very similar in a lot of ways.
Yeah, this show is kind of doing the Homeland thing, right? Where you're like, man, every time a Homeland season would come out, you'd be like, how did they time this so well? They seem to be talking about a lot of the stuff that we're dealing with right
this
second.
How did they know?
Yeah. And there's some of that going on with Perry Mason, too, for sure.
Yeah, I've thoroughly enjoyed it so far, man. I think our beat cop is phenomenal. Our lawyers are great. Lithgow is killing it.
Oh, Lithgow is so good, dude. He is so good.
At everything he does, yeah. He's incredible.
The acting all across is top-notch. I'm loving Matthew Rhys. Shea Whigham, who just like... I just feel like he's at the... Every show that gets put out, Shea Whigham is like on the casting call. Like they're like, oh, we should probably bring in Shea.
He just lives at the HBO studios, Barrett. He doesn't even leave anymore.
The acting is phenomenal, top notch. But Lithgow especially, I haven't always been a Lithgow fan.
Right.
Because he's kind of quirky. He's kind of got, you know, he's got this
Third Rock from the Sun is what put him in that spot in my head.
And he's a great bad guy in the infamous season 4 of Dexter.
That's what brought him to the forefront of actors for me, with season 4 of Dexter.
But this is just like a really, really good, like, this is such a good performance from him that I really, and I like it. You know, you can, it's just a juicy character he's got going here. I like
this.
EP
is where I end up giving Tim Van Patten and Denise Ergoven, I believe her last name is, a lot of credit directing, because every character on this show is well acted. Perry Mason, Matthew crushes it. Even down to Della, the secretary of E.B. Jonathan. All these people crush their roles. Lithgow is unbelievable at bringing sort of like the... You know what he did? He shows me everybody has an angle. Everybody has their own angle too. Yes, he's trying to get justice for this family or whatever, but really it's also about this personal rivalry with him and this DA. And how complicated criminal activity becomes as a result of everybody trying to put their own spin and angle on it, and the judges and the lawyers and the jury and the religious side of it and all the shit that goes on. I mean, they've just done a really good job of painting this full picture of society and around this tragic event, and we don't know exactly how it happened or why it happened yet, but we're getting there very quickly, and we know it's not good. We know it's not going to be a good thing. By the way, you mentioned the budget was huge for this one, and we found out why. It's the World War I scenes. $74.3 million for season one, man. And
yeah.
I'm betting that was 60%, 70% on these World War I scenes, and it was the one thing that I found myself questioning. I was like, man, I wonder if they're pissed 1917 came out last year, because visually you can't stand up to that.
Here's the thing. I was thinking about this, because those scenes are very well done. But they are small scale.
Well, comparatively, everything is.
And they are doing a lot with the sky and the background to make it very gritty and gray, which means they didn't have to do location, is my guess. Now I'm sure that building out the trench set was very expensive. But just think, the reason that you need that much money is because period pieces. Mm. You got think about how expensive that is. You have to make everything look old.
The scene in episode 2,
they got to turn everything into 1930.
End of episode 2, they're zooming out and you see the whole city. That street. And you see the street lights and you see all of the old-timey cars and the old-timey buildings, and all of that shit costs money, bro. It's CGI. Getting all that to look right is very expensive.
Yes, totally. All the costumes, all the set dressing, everything. But you're definitely right. These World War II flashbacks were certainly not an inexpensive piece of the puzzle.
No,
because they look, I mean, they don't look like 1917, but they look
good.
They look good.
For TV especially. Like, the second that it started rolling, I was like, oh boy, here we go. This is going to be tough. Good luck standing up against
Overwatch. Right there. God. I know I can't keep talking about this, but dude, I can't get over
Trench Warfare fucked you up, dude.
Like, this shit was so insane.
Bro.
I just don't understand how dudes got over there and just were like, nope, and just sprinted away, anywhere, any direction, just away from the trench.
You would literally sit in the trench, and then one guy, Barrett, one guy would come out and blow a whistle, and then all of you would sprint out of the trench, and then in the next trench, there'd just be like 1/6 as many of you, and then you would do it again. And that was the war.
Ugh.
That doesn't seem like a productive way to do, frankly, anything. We were wildly undervaluing human life.
Yeah, I know that. Yes, exactly.
What the fuck? At no point was anybody on either side like, bros, this is just not the ticket. We are burning money in people like it has never been seen before. Yeah. Anyway, World War I was crazy complicated, dude. If you ever go, like, for those of you who are history students or history lovers, you know, we always think of World War II as a sort of simple good versus evil, Hitler versus good scenario. World War I, that you know, and a lot of people argue, is what set us up for World War II, is it was fucking chaos to a degree that I did not realize or remember until 1917. And then now, look, I love that they've gotten us there, but I hope we don't spend too much time with it, just because it's like, I basically get it. It's hell on earth to watch, I don't know how much more that I need before I understand that Perry's tortured. So, 2 episodes in, man, this is, look, weird IP, strange brand. Huge win through two episodes, in my opinion.
Yeah, and this is what we count on HBO for, right? Like, they just drop this in here, and they're like, oh, hey, shit, this is dope.
Better than most things on television.
Yeah. And so, you know, now we're obviously, like, we just talked about this. This originally was starring Robert Downey Jr. It's got Matthew Reese and John Lithgow and a huge cast and a wild budget. This is supposed to be good. It's not an accident that this is good. It just kind of came through with little fanfare.
At a random time in the weirdest point in our lives.
At a random time. Yeah. So, and pandemic notwithstanding, maybe this was kind of a big summer event for HBO. Like, they do a lot of their big stuff in the summer. Game of Thrones last summer. Like, right? So it's not crazy. The timing is not crazy. It just kind of dropped in our laps here. Unexpectedly a little bit, and it's this big, big budget, awesome show with phenomenal acting and directing and writing and everything in between. And if it keeps humming like this, man, it's top notch. We've been distracted by the World War One scenes, but I think this is the first time I've seen a dead baby since Trainspotting. And I really didn't need Perry messing with the shotgun victims. Jawbone and teeth. That was they really lingered on that shot, and oh my god, I'm not sure I've ever seen anything more grisly on a TV show.
It takes a lot to get me to look away.
That was essentially intense.
At this point, that's what it takes. You would have to linger on a half blown open dead body, and then have your main character tinker with some of the pieces hanging out in order to get me to look away. And so about 10 seconds into staring at this half of a head, I was like, yeah, I'm going to go back to my phone for a few seconds here. This isn't...
Yeah, I kept thinking they were just going to do like those split second brushes on it. And then they're saying something to you with that. They're like, no, we're going to hang on. We're going to hang out here. We're going to let him use his little pencil thing to mess with the fucking
I ended
mouth.
Up loving the letter when they go to the letter. And he was so distraught, or we don't know yet, in typing it.
Yeah, he got mad.
That they made it look so real, though. Like, the first line is broken. He goes into a second line, and then there's like, made it look like this man who was grappling with this thing. And that clearly, there is more to it.
Well, story-wise, it took me a while. It took me minutes after the episode ended to figure it all out. You know who that is, right?
The man that... Emily was having an affair with, right?
Yes. That's the guy that jumped off the roof, though.
Oh, shit.
That's the plot. That's why the cops want him to be coming down the stairs, because he's saying that the two guys he helped are dead at 79th and Hoover, so they're framing him for murdering his partners.
Okay. Why do the cops want this to go away like that?
Because our one cop is involved somehow.
Fucking.
Or the guy that looks like he was born to be in a 1930s
as a bad
noir,
detective.
Crime. As a bad detective, yes.
Last thing I'll...
Like, that dude, that is the face of a bad, corrupt 1930s.
Last thing I'll say about Perry Mason, and it's another element of the show that I've really enjoyed so far, and I actually played a video game, I believe it was on PlayStation 4, called L.A. Noir. That's what they called the video game. And you play a detective where you go solve grisly Los Angeles 1930s crimes. It's a pretty dope game. If you ever get the chance to play it, I highly recommend it. That being said, every time you turn to a clue in this game, you get this like sound effect, all right? So if you're looking around a room and you finally hit the piece of paper you're looking for, and it'll be like, like give you this L.A. Noir-like sound, like we've discovered something. They use that shit in Perry Mason. When he turns to the letter in that room, it goes like, it like has those little noises to let you know.
Right,
here's why I love
that
shit. Bro, none of us do a good job of staring at the screen the whole time in 2020. There's a lot going on. Giving me a sound effect to let me know my ass needs to look up at the screen because something very important is happening. Clutch, baby. I love the move. Thank you very much for making it cool. Love the show so far. Everything about it has been great. Psyched for episode 3.
Yes, absolutely.
That will do it for today's episode of OCC. Huge thanks to our sponsor this week. It is you. And everyone on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles, as we did not have a regularly scheduled sponsor for this episode, you guys are the supporters making this show happen and making sure that Barrett and I remain at least partially employed. If you want to support the show in exchange for either 3 or 4 ad-free exclusive episodes every week, go to patreon.com/oystersclamscockles and enjoy. Follow us on social media. We're on Instagram at oystersclamscockles. We're on Twitter at clamsandcockles. We're also on facebook.com/oystersclamscockles. My name is Ross Bolin. You can follow me at WRBOLEN, at WRBolin on Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. And you can listen to the Ross Bolin podcast, my other podcast, wherever you listen to OCC. Mr. Dudley, where can we follow you on social media and hear more of your voice?
Follow me at Barrett Dudley on Instagram and Twitter, and check out the Club Cool podcast wherever you're listening to OCC. Just search for Club Cool. I co-host with Phil Battaglia,
Philly,
over there.
Little known secret, my big brother in my fraternity in college.
That's right. We just talk. We talk style and pop culture and art and McDonald's. All sorts of cool jazz like that.
We will be back next week to talk Perry Mason episode. What will we only have 3 at that point?
Yeah. This is 1 a week, baby. This is classic HBO, and we're all caught up now.
Got it.
So
that's good.
That's fine. Gives us room to Dark didn't come out until Saturday, and so we really only had a few days. And we wanted to get all caught up on Perry Mason. So now we've got the rest of the week to keep watching Dark. I think I'll probably be halfway through. I think I'll probably be through 4 episodes.
Let's try to do that. Let's say we want to go through episode 4 of Dark, episode 3 of Perry Mason, and then, of course, anything else we watch and any tidbits and such we can get to as well next week, we'll bring along.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't have any tidbits this week. Just, no tidbits came across my desk, but I'm sure they will this next week.
I'll send you some such, just in case tidbits come across, at least you'll have some such.
That would be helpful. Yeah.
Thank you all for listening. Until our next helping, goodbye, friends.